Good afternoon and welcome to a meeting of our Liberia Working Group. I'm Dorina Biko. I'm with the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention here at USIP. And today we are discussing disarmament and demobilized soldiers. What has DDR accomplished? How are demobilized soldiers living? What challenges do they face? How do they deal with psychosocial stress in an environment with Liberia, an environment like Liberia? And we will hear from Gwendolyn Taylor and Johnson Bohr and Morley Zewu, two founders of the National National Ex-Combatant Peacebuilding Initiative, which they founded in Liberia. And this is a project that has been run by CHF International. I will turn it over to Rick Hill, who's the director of CHF International's Office of Strategic and Technical Support, to just give us a little bit of background about the project and about the presenters before they get into their presentation.
Probably not deserved yet. I just wanted to say a few words about why we did this and how we got into it. CHF's been working in Liberia now for 4 or 5 years, and in other places where we deal a lot with ex-combatants. And as we looked at what we were trying to do and contributing to stability in a lot of these places, we looked, of course, quite closely at ex-combatants because the conventional wisdom is that they are one of the sources of instability post-war. And we saw a lot of literature and a lot of research that had to do with looking at why an ex-combatant would fight, for instance, and a lot of looking as well at the containment, the cantonment process and the initial demobilization process. But relatively little did we find about what was happening to ex-combatants down the road, and particularly the effect of demobilization programs. And as we begin to think about the conventional wisdom about why we should pay attention to ex-combatants, and that is that they need to be returned to a productive role in society and a role where they're not inclined to use violence again. And yet the conventional wisdom is that an ex-combatant is somebody who has learned to use violence and that's a very real possibility. And so we ask ourselves, well, what would make it, what makes the difference in terms of whether they want to use violence again? What are the elements that contribute to their ability to want to be productive citizens again? And this conventional wisdom that, if you don't do that well, there's a lot of discontented ex-combatants out there who will take up arms again and be the source of another war, at least instability in the society. We saw very little that really gave us a lot of good information about that. And so we asked USIP if we could look at that, and we're very grateful for the opportunity and the fact that they said yes. They gave us a grant to do this in Liberia, where we had worked and we had the basis to be able to do that productively. The various events in my life have led me recently to really be grateful for growing up in this country, really, and living a life where very few mornings I had to wake up where I was not safe and dry. We're going to hear today from two people who, unfortunately, for most of their lives, they didn't have that advantage and that privilege. In fact, from a very young age, very often they woke up when they weren't safe and dry. And they have weathered many years of war in Liberia and now have formed an organization that helps their fellow ex-combatants try and be part of the solution now. As I said, we're very grateful to USIP for helping us do this, and I think it's appropriate in that USIP, it seems to me, is an organization that encapsulated mission is to go out and try and help other societies, help its citizens, its leaders, its organizations develop and deal with the issues that keep its citizens from expecting to be able to wake up safe and dry, and that and the understanding that this study is going to contribute to that, I think, was important in their decision to help us go ahead and do that. The today we'll hear. I just wanted to also thank my co-researchers on this, John Timmon, who's sitting here in front from CHF, who is really the organizational engine behind this project, and whose increasing understanding and dedication to the issues that create instability in Africa, and particularly in Liberia, where he's worked quite a bit, was really important to the project. And Gwen Taylor, who whose intellectual and methodological rigor really made this project the give us the data that is really meaningful. I think John would agree also that Gwen is really the heart of the project in many ways, and was the main reason that we have Zawu and Johnson here with us today. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to her and let her tell you a little bit about the data and perhaps some of the other reasons why we decided to do this, and then we're going to hear from Zawu and Johnson, and then hopefully before the end of the hour get to your questions and have more than an hour to allow you to drive the information release here. So thanks.
Can you come over there? Just tell you when.
Hi. Thanks, Rick. I just want to say, first of all, a huge thank you to CHF International for really conceiving of this project, which I think was incredibly important, and to USIP for being incredibly supportive throughout. I mean, this really went much more smoothly than anyone has a right to expect a Liberian project to go, and we're all really grateful. So what I want to do is just say a couple of words about the project that CHF did in partnership with NEPA here. And we've got our founders here with us today and their first trip to America. So we're really, really fortunate for that. And I don't want to take too much time. I want to turn the floor over to them as soon as possible. So let me run through just a little background for you. Great, thanks. John, could I get you to flip? So Rick has already introduced you to exactly what we were trying to do with the survey. It's a survey on the extent to which ex-combatants have been able to reintegrate into their communities. Okay, so we had a couple of key goals. We wanted to learn a little bit about the survival strategies that were being used, a little bit about the long-term prospects for reintegration, which is something there's very little literature about right now, academically and in the policy sphere. And we wanted to know a little bit more about what the risks are for a return to violence in Liberia. The survey was conducted in Lofa County. I think probably a lot of you are familiar with the layout of Liberia. Lofa is up on the Guinea border. And then we were lucky to be able to supplement that research with some work in Monrovia. So in total, we had a total sample of over 1,400 people, which is an enormous sample. We were very lucky to have that many. Now, as many of you know, I'm sure, statistics, especially reliable statistics in Liberia, are hard to come by, which makes random sampling a real challenge methodologically when you're doing survey work in countries like Liberia. We did have good numbers on the number of ex-combatants that went through DDR in our three districts in Lofa that we were working in. That's Voinjima, Zorzor, and Salie. And within the communities, we had a sense of what were large and what were small communities. So we could use that information in order to get a fair sense of what proportion of ex-combatants should come from each district, and within those districts, how many ex-combatants we needed to talk to per town. So what we would do methodologically to go in and randomly sample is bring together all of the ex-combatants in the town, and then use the process that you see in the photo here by which ex-combatants would randomly take a card. And if the card indicated that they were to be surveyed, then we would speak to them. And if it didn't, then they knew that they were willing to come give me any information that they wanted me to have about anything that was on their mind having to do with social or economic reintegration, but they did not formally participate in the survey. So this way, we could ensure that respondents were selected randomly within the communities where we worked. So I just want to talk to you a little bit about some of the major findings that I think are especially applicable to what we're going to be discussing today. And let me start with some of the findings that have to do with the economic situation of ex-combatants. In Monrovia, roughly 70% of our respondents had gone through DD. So, you know, make a mental note that that means 30% of the people that we talked to never participated in DD, not RR, but the DD process. And this is something that I think is downplayed a lot when people talk about demobilization in Liberia. You hear a lot of information about the extent to which people that did not fight were able to get a hold of ammunition, get a hold of a gun, and come receive the benefits that came with demobilizing, even though they were not, strictly speaking, ex-combatants. Well, there's a flip side to that, okay? And that flip side is that there was an entire population of people that were wounded at the wrong time and hospitalized during DD, that had their arm taken away from them by their commander and reissued to someone who was closer to the commander, or who were simply afraid of the process, or were advised by their family or friends not to go through DD. And I think Zhao and Johnson are going to be able to give us some really good information about what the perception of the demobilization process was in that early phase. Okay. In Lofa, slightly more went through DD. But in Monrovia, about 40% of the people we talked to had done an RR program. In Lofa, that number was halved. Okay, so with Lofa, they're still waiting for reintegration programs, training programs to come through. In both locations, the factor that's most associated with current employment is not having gone through that RR program. Rather, it's whether they were employed in the past. Ex-combatants are surviving in Lofa largely by hunting, cutting palm, agriculture, the things that Lofa is traditionally associated with. And in Monrovia, you're seeing the plurality of ex-combatants surviving by day-to-day contracts, short-term contracts, rather than actual permanent employment. And interestingly enough, you know, part of what we wanted to do with this survey is ask the ex-combatants, ask the respondents what they thought were the industries that had the most potential, what the jobs were that they would want to do. This is not something people generally do research on. And when we asked the ex-combatants that we talked to what they thought had the most potential in Lofa, the plurality, I think 60%, said, well, it's agriculture. This makes sense. Lofa is typically conceived of as the breadbasket of Liberia. However, I believe it was 6% of the ex-combatants in Lofa that we spoke to had chosen agriculture as the training program they wanted to receive. So there's a disconnect there. And it's a disconnect that I think that reintegration programming needs to take seriously. One of the key aspects to economic reintegration is the ability to reintegrate socially as well, especially in countries, in communities, in which the economic livelihood is based in large part on social networks. So some of the things that we were also looking at is the extent to which these respondents felt as though they truly reintegrated with their community. 65% of our Lofa respondents thought that the community saw the population of ex-combatants in a positive light. Okay? So a positive light would be with respect or with acceptance. All right, but that number decreases quite a bit in Monrovia, down to 41%. And in both Lofa and Monrovia, about 80% of people that came back to their families and communities felt as though they were accepted. So there's still 20% who had some kind of trouble reintegrating. And there's not much of a relationship between the employment status those respondents had and the extent to which they felt as though they were able to reintegrate. But I think that a key finding, and something that we're going to hear some more about from both Johnson and Zhao, is the fact that those respondents in Lofa who were actually doing RR programs were in fact more likely to say they thought the community viewed them negatively. Now, I do want to point out part of this is because in the urban areas in Lofa, if you can call them urban, Voinjima and Zorzor, there is more friction between the community and the ex-combatants. It's also the case that the urban areas are where the reintegration programs are. Okay? So there's that issue. But it is still the case that even if you hold urban areas aside, there is some tension caused by these RR programs with the community. And finally, I just want to talk to you a little bit about our findings in terms of the ex-combatants who would consider in the future some conditions that would lead them to return to war. Now, the vast majority, 71% of the people we talked to said, no, there is no way, there are no circumstances that will lead me to go back and fight. However, that leaves 29% that said, even if I won't go back and fight right now, I can think of a scenario in which I would go back to war. Okay? And the plurality of those respondents said, the reasons I can envision going back to war are because of lack of benefits, poverty, and hardship. Okay? And those that say that they can see going back to war in the future for some reason are also more likely to be the ones that are having more trouble reintegrating now. So what I want to tie this in is to some of the contributions that NEPA as an organization in Liberia is making on the ground. NEPA is an organization that incorporates both ex-combatants and civilians from all tribes, from all factions, in an effort to build peace in Liberia, to mediate conflicts, to teach about conflict management, and to bring communities and ex-combatants together to constructively and peacefully solve problems. And what NEPA has done and what they are currently doing is making a major effort to work towards a smooth, productive DDRR process. They'll tell you more about that. To reduce the tensions between the ex-combatants and the communities they're returning to, and as we've seen by the fact that the people in the RR programs perceive the community as seeing them more negatively, this is a key feature of what needs to be done now, and we have NEPA tackling that. And finally, NEPA is teaching skills to deal with problems constructively, productively, and without using violence. And considering the 29% of the people that we spoke to said that there are reasons they can envision in the future in which they would have to go back to war, nothing could be more important than this. And it's for that reason that I think hearing from NEPA directly instead of through me or through other Americans that have gone to Liberia is so important. And they're here today to give you their firsthand perspective. We are really fortunate. We went through a lot to get these visas, and without USIP, it never would have happened. So I want to introduce and thank very wholeheartedly Morley Guguzau Sr. and Kay Johnson Bohr, and turn the floor over to them.
Okay, I'm Kay Johnson Boy, the National Program Coordinator of NEPA. It's a community-based organization back in Liberia. But I first want to extend a thanks to our good family that actually processed our being here. And that has to do with USRP, CHF, Union College, and that of NYU. It was very difficult because even at the embassy where you get, you see multitude of people who wanting to get to America and being denied on a daily basis. People come from all of the embassy with their hands on their hair crying. So in fact, on a series of occasions, we had Lee going at the embassy, watching people going through the interview to actually see how the process was. So just imagine how difficult it was actually. And one good story he came from there was that I think it was better that no black's hand was in the 9/11. So that was a kind of fun that we were sharing. Just kidding. Okay, I will give you a little bit about myself. I was a former fighter from the MPFL that was led by Charles Taylor, because in Liberia we had two sets of civil war. And I participated in the first phase of the civil war. And I actually got connected by means of my family being killed. My father and mothers were killed just from some argument with some soldiers when they came in the yard to collect vehicle, and it's like we never actually knew what was happening. Arguing from one point to another, there was a gunfire. And in that process, we were left, because at that time I was just age 19 in the 9th grade from St. Peter Clever High School. We never had any way out. And our two brothers that we were also depending on that could have processed us in terms of protection and feeling was also killed. So that actually compelled me to join. And when the war ended, I was fortunate to have getting in contact with the Lutheran Trauma Healing and Reconciliation Program that actually did a lot of psychosocial related training with us, and we were able to go through the walls of the awareness capacity building. And because of our interest and the kind of confidence they saw in us and activeness, they decided that we could actually go forward to get some training in the trainers of trainer course. And we also did that. Through those training, we got in connection with WADNEP that also gave us additional training in nonviolent peace educations and what have you. But when we came back from those training, Lutheran engaged us in a series of training activities in the community where ex-combatant was actually concentrated, and it was difficult to penetrate. But from our background, or with our background, we were using this kind of a past relationship to penetrate those areas to make sure that their influence can be made in those communities. And then we went back for applied knowledge in the kind of a training program coming up with those from those communities and sharing experience from the community, what were the challenges and what have you. And there were challenges that would be similar to other communities that people got over. And you share those stories to each other and giving each other some confidence as to how you can also get over on your return. But there was a commitment where we saw other organizations, you know, actually channeling their focus towards displaced people, other community-related problems, and no one could actually direct their focus towards ex-combatants. And it's like we were shocked. And God had it well for us, because at that training, I met Lee, Zelius, and other friends who also went through the war and who were former combatants. So it's that we have to get together with that focus of working with ex-combatants, since in fact everybody was like a friend to work with ex-combatants. So we came from that training with an idea of formulating NEPA that we are talking about today. So we were actually looking at the kind of problem that was in the community when it comes to recycling of army and all of this stuff. So NEPA actually came to be to avert that particular trend that we are talking about. And Lutheran World Service was also very instrumental of giving us some push to have gone through the process of accreditations and what have you. And we got involved into the community work. And they was the very first institution that started giving us support. And blessedly for us, when the DD for the second phase of the Civil War started, they were looking for competent ex-combatants that have had a lot of training that could use their experience and relationship in the DD process, serving as pre-discharge orientation, you know, staff and what have you. So World Service also used that means to collaborate with us so that we could participate in that process. And we were fortunate to have been the cattlemen at Bong County, at Kari, Nimba, and that of Grand Bassa, where we actually processed over 20,000 ex-combatants in that area. And while we were there, CHF also contacted us, because the people used to come at the cattlemen to actually see what was going on, how presentation was being made, and what have you. And they had a tedious work in Lofa to do, but arms were staying in Lofa, guys were staying in arm in Lofa, and the DDR actually went there lately. So to actually get in the community was a kind of difficult stuff. And being that we actually came from that background and we understood the language of the guys, we knew the psychology of the guys, that also made it perfect. Moreover, I also come from Lofa County, understand the culture and speak the language. That was a kind of a breaking ends and what have you. So we got involved with their programs, and it actually put NEPA on top of issues where a lot of institutions, international and local-based institutions that were implementing programs decided to work with us. We worked with CHF in so many different projects. We worked with Erie Scatter Center, UK. We were able to work with the Liberian Transitional Initiative that were getting support from OTI and USRD. And we worked with the IRC, some human rights-related program. And presently, we are processing a work with the Lehman Action, a kind of organization from Britain and what have you. So there was a lot. You see. And on the issue of disarmament and reintegration, there were some lapses that actually we saw, because people come from different school of thought. Our school of thought says that reintegration actually is just training. After you have disarmed people and gave them skills, it is sufficient that they can use those skills to have themselves reinserted into community and they can get employment and what have you. But we also came from a different school of thought, given the kind of situations in our own community. is such that we believe that reintegration goes beyond training, where in psychosocial, there has to be some solid psychosocial related activities in those communities. That has to do with, if you look at the cycle of reintegration, you will actually get to understand that due to the fact of reintegration, there might have been community that was integrated. And that community might have had rules and regulations, norms and culture existing in those communities. And at the point of disintegration, you need to understand that there was a lot of activity in that short process where rules were breaking, norms were not respected anymore, culture were devastated, and even the sons and daughters of those communities were the ones burying their hands in this kind of warfare. So there were terrifying situations in those communities and what have you. And now, at the point of reintegration, it's very much necessary that the community be softened before the guys can return. And in softening such a community, you actually need some solid psychosocial related program. And the exit strategy in the reintegration program in Liberia did not focus actually at that point because they came from a different school of thought. And this is where we are actually being geared towards bridging that gap between the ex-combatants on one hand and the community dwellers. You will find out that the guys might have gone through the RR, they have their certificate. And even if they came to an institution trying to like apply just for a security job, when they found out that you are an ex-combatant, they don't give you the job because they don't trust you. You find out that people have skills and they return to community and they want to get themselves involved in other community-related work. Because that cohesion at the community level is not yet being built, there is a gap. So that person will not also be given a chance. So these are situations that are happening. Other people were fortunate to have gone through the process by means of their own family members. Because that's one entry point where if the family accepts you in the community, they can help you go through the process by performing their own ceremony in terms of reuniting you in that community. More people are getting successful through that process. But this is where we stand. And now, because of these issues, you find out that a lot of the guys are getting discouraged. They have the certificate from this kind of a good program, but now they can't get their way out. And for means of livelihood, you will find some people getting involved into palm cutting and hunting and what have you, just to make life well for themselves. But a lot of these guys have family, children that they need to cater to. Some also are going through self-employment where if you knew how to drive, you find yourself in the taxi driver cycling and what have you. Others find themselves in street corners helping to get people on car. It is not like the American situation where if you go to the subway, you use a train card and the train come and stop and you get in it. In Monrovia, you actually fight before you get on car. Fight. So you can wear your good clothes and you get to the area. You will have to depend on a car loader who will fight over car, take seat for you, and then before you can get in, you take. Or else, you will definitely not go to work because you will get dirty. And nobody will want to care whether they step on you and what have you because it's the kind of a survival, the fittest. So those situations are there. Others find themselves in those small-scale businesses wherein they serve like the Yano boys, holding plastic in their hands, selling around coffee books and what have you just to make life. Other people are wheelbarrow boys. People come from upcountry with loads and what have you in a car and they want to get it to a specific destination. They need wheelbarrows to tow it to those destinations. So guys find themselves in those areas. But when you look at the complexity in the DD program, you find out that a lot of the guys did not also go through the process because of some other factors. Some of them were actually wounded and they were in a hospital when the process was going on. Some were in other locations like the Ivory Coast, Sierra Leone, and what have you, Guinea. They did not also participate in the process. Some of them were disarmed because that was like a kind of normal process that always used to go on. Whenever the disarmament is coming on, the commander will disarm you and then pack the arm into a kind of a container so that when a peacekeeper come, they can give the container with the belief that it will just be a smooth process so that the guys can be registered. But the peacekeeper also felt like there were more arms in the country. So even if you had disarmed your unit ahead of time and submitted that particular container, they still expected these guys to go and get armed and come and disarm. That was also frustrating, where a lot of the guys' arms were taken from them and they had no means of disarming. Some could not go to disarm because there was a kind of rumors around that if you went to disarm, they are going to keep record on you. And if there is an opportunity to travel, if you got at the embassy, because a lot of Liberians want to be in the U.S. So when they talk about traveling, that's the very first area they think about. So if you went through the DDR, your photo will be at the embassy. And if you went for visa, they will check in the computer and they will know that you fought war and you will not have the opportunity to travel. So you found out that a lot of the guys shy away from the DD. And you also found out that there were people in the war that already had money through looting and what have you, looking at the opportunity from the DDSR and also looking at what they already have, they decided not to partake into it. So those are different categories. You also found out that because of that huge number of people that did not go through DD and also have low educational background, who don't have the process of going to school and other aspects, find yourself in the stock of armed robbery. And most of you who check on the net, I think you can get all kind of information from Liberia. It's not like in America wherein, like when we were at the union, whenever we leave in the house, I will ask grandmother, I say, oh, but nobody in the house? And she would tell me, no. And it's like, we leave the doors open and what have you, go where we want to go in the evening when we come, only the pets will be in the house. So it was amazing. In Liberia, when you are going even to the bathroom, you need to lock your door. Yes. So those were a kind of situation on our side, and these are situations that actually stay continuing. Yeah. And with the kind of exercise we went through, we're able to even take hold of some of those actual areas that these guys are in, much, you know, quantity, you know, kind of a group and what have you, so that you could see the real aspect of what we're talking about. I will stop that far, and Lee will be able to carry on the rest of the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Johnson. Okay, my name is Molly Guguzau. I'm a former child soldier. And it happens that when the war came to Liberia, I was somewhere in Bomi County. There's a province in Liberia that is named Bomi County. It's a county and not too far from Monrovia. Because we felt that the war was going to stop to Monrovia, since in fact that is where the executive mansion is, the home of the president. But to our surprise, the war came down to Tubman. Unfortunately for me, I went on this training base where the commander used to live in order to get some food. Because when the soldiers took over Tubman, they had access to food. They looted every food and broke through every homes and stores. So most of the time people went at the commander base to get some food. So when I went to the base that very day, I was being arrested, forcibly taken to the battlefront. And that was how they incorporated me into the fighting force. But then I was really afraid because I never had an idea about weapon, even about battle, so I was very much afraid. And then when the commander noticed that, he brought me back to his base and decided to have an interview. So during this interview, he was very surprised to know that I was a ninth grade student at that time, and 15 years old. Because among those guys, you hardly find somebody with some level of, you know, somebody with some level of education, like fifth or sixth grade. And these were special forces, Charles Taylor special forces. You could hardly find a graduate, I mean a high school graduate. They were just a bunch of ignorance, but very terrible. These were guerrillas, and they stabilized anywhere at a particular time. And then during the interview, he found out that I had some level of education, so he decided to make use of me. The first thing he told me to do is to get the names of the different type of weapons, the serial number, and assign these weapons to each soldiers according to your name, your serial number, and things like that. So if they notice that there is a kind of weapon that is missing and then your name is attached to it, they kill you for that. So they took those weapons very important. So when you went to the battlefront and then you came back, you must always have your weapon. If there's an infantry and then they found out that weapon is not seen, you are also executed. But in all of those activities, I was still afraid because I never had any training and I never had any experience of the war. So he sent me on the training base, right in Todmenberg. I had this 6th Infantry Battalion base, and that was where he sent me. And then we went on this training base. There were a lot of other things that we learned during the training base. In fact, that when you are taken to the training base, the next morning, they will have to whisk water on you and use this a military beer and give you like 100 lashes. And they will tell you not to cry. So they will whip you painfully, and then you dare screaming and in order to initiate you. And then thereafter, you do some physical exercises to show you different types of the weapons and other things like that. And sometimes when they come with some guys on the training base, like enemies caught at the battlefront, they will use us to have them killed. Either we behead and behead them or open their stomach or something just to make sure that they make you brave into what you need to do. And then during the training, we're also told that these guns we are giving you is your mother and is your father. Anybody who try to resist your authority, it means that they are your enemy. So even if your brother or sister or mother or father stand before you to even advise you that you don't need to fight, you got water, dinner, yet, you could even get rid of them. So that was the kind of initiation they gave us. And then from there, at the end of the graduation, I was taken on the battlefront, heading a squad. Like I had like 10 persons under my command. And that was how we started fighting from one battlefront to another. We lived in the jungle for years at the battlefront fighting. And then from there, the commander called upon me, and then I began to serve as a special bodyguard unit commander to the late Oliver Vanney. He was the battalion commander for Bomi County, Grand Cape, and Gbapolu at that time. Before his death, Charles Taylor made him a major general. Yeah. So, but what happened is that even during my time with him, I was being used as a killing machine. Because if he arrests anybody and then he gives me a command to kill, I kill. That was how I was operating, up to the point that when the autopilot started, we were again called upon to move to Monrovia and destabilize Monrovia. So we were fighting, and during the war, that was how I got wounded, and then my hand got broken. Then I was taken to Nema County, somewhere closer to the Guinean border. After I recovered, I was again afraid because I had lost 2 brothers during the war. My hand got broken, and the information about me was that I was dead from the news I gathered from Monrovia. So my parents were worried about me. And so I began to find some escape route to leave Greater Liberia at that time, because the rebel control area was called Greater Liberia, and then Monrovia was like smaller Liberia. So I began to find an escape route. Because if you just notice that you try to escape, or you don't have that desire to go on the battlefront, they could get rid of you. So that was the kind of system we found ourselves in. So what happened is that I crossed over to Guinea. There's a little town called Tio in Guinea, somewhere closer to Zaire. And then I obtained this refugee card as a Liberian. And then that was how I got on this UN truck, UN launch, Liberia United for Humanity. And then I came to Monrovia. But when I got to Monrovia, I was still afraid because Monrovia was looking so strange to me, and I was new in the area. So I had to move to the displaced camp in VOA, where my parents were, and then my mother embraced me. But my father was again skeptical. And for the father, he was afraid to know that I'm a rebel, had been involved in the killing, so it was dangerous having me around. But my mother kept encouraging me. She took me for some spiritual cleansing, and then after some counseling and things like that, I began to have some hope. She asked me what I want to do. I told her I want to go back to school and things like that. And then after the 1996 and 97 election, when Charles Taylor won the election, that was how we moved back to Todmenberg, Bomi County, because that was our original home. And then during the process, we encountered the Lutheran Trauma Healing and Reconciliation Program. And then during the trauma healing activities, there were opportunities giving us to share our testimony about what we went through during the war, what were our experiences, what happened to us, or what we did, and things like that. So when I shared this testimony, they were very much interested. So they decided that we'd be giving some advanced training to serve as peace advocates. So after that training, we were sent to this advanced training. And then after the advanced training, and it was during that training, because I started knowing Johnson when we met in Yekepa after my hand got broken. And then surprisingly, again, when I came to Monrovia after some years, when I went for this advanced training, I saw him there. And that was when our friendship actually grew. And after this training, there were a lot of commitment made in terms of who you want to work with or what level of commitment you want to adapt in order to help with the rebuilding process in Liberia. And one thing we sensed is that people were very much critical and afraid about working with ex-combatants because it was actually risky. Because these are guys that when you are working with, anything could happen. They could get rid of you or they could destroy your logistics or something. So international and local organizations could not easily work with ex-combatants. So people were very much afraid. So we took up the challenge and with the commitment that since in fact we came from that background with this level of transformation and that we can work with the ex-combatants. And then people said, but you guys are sure? You think it's that easy? I said, it's not really easy, but we have that desire and we think we can make the difference. And that was how we established the National Ex-Combatant Peacebuilding Initiatives. And when the organization was established, we were again giving some support and encouragement by the same group of people that trained us, the Lutheran Trauma Healing in a program. But there are a few things I want to leave with you in terms of the DD and RR. The first issue really has to do with the meaning of the DD RR to the ex-combatant population. The first thing is that for some ex-combatants, they saw the DD RR as a means of total peace, stability, security, and development. Because most of these guys suffered this war fatigue, and you could not easily leave the war when you are a part of the war. So they saw the DD RR as a means of freedom, and then what you can go about with your own life. But another group of ex-combatants saw the DD RR as a means of some commercial gain. For the fact that the more arms you had, and through some other mechanism, you could get more money. Because the process was about you giving a gun, and then you are registered and giving cash benefit and some other training benefits. So most of the commanders also saw that as an opportunity where they in fight or disarmed some ex-combatants prior to the process. And then the next thing again is that some other ex-combatants saw the process as a means of total transformation, where they can get some skills, improve themselves, and go about with normal life, that the war is over. So in terms of livelihood for ex-combatants, some are actually surviving through the means of self-employment with their past skills, with their present skills, so they are going on with their life. What a war, no war, they are managing. There are some who are also being gainfully employed by some private and governmental institutions. Some are working with international organizations and local organizations. Some are drivers, some are securities and things like that. And there are others who are surviving through small and big skills and businesses where some of these guys have their carpentry shop, some of these guys have their widow markets, some are shoe shine boys, car loaders and things like what Johnson said. And some are also living through some criminal activities like armed robbery. There is a high rate of armed robbery in Monrovia, really. And sometimes the security or army try to counteract these guys, but it's actually a difficult thing because you don't know where they are, you don't know by what means they have guns, but somehow they go about with these criminal activities. Some are also involved in a kind of drug sales. They are drug dealers. And then lastly, I want to leave with you the risks in terms of the reintegration. What are the complications, the challenges and things when it comes to the reintegration? One thing we experienced that, as former combatants during that went through the first process of the DDRR was that this second phase was very short. Because I was serving as supervisor for the cantonment in Buchanan. I went to supervise the pre-discharge orientation. The first thing is that there were limited time given the ex-combatants. Every ex-com that went at the cantonment, they spent at most 5 days. The 6 days they went out. So, and that was not really sufficient. Somebody had been fighting war for 14 years. You bring them just within 5 days to tell them, give them basic counsel and what they need to do to organize their life was not really adequate. But that was the kind of standard that UNDP and other institutions came out with. The next issue has to do with the non-DDRR registered ex-combatant. That's why my colleague said, So an ex-command, he said, I'm not a registrar. Most of the training in the Monrovia area from the statistic that Gwen gave, you found out that only 70% went through the DD. What happens with the 30%? Some decided that I can't go through the process because if I go through the process, there will be a kind of track record on me that I'm a former ESCOM and the kind of opportunities that I may have in the future, like traveling, like education, yeah, I may not receive it. So that was the perception that people grew. So they didn't go. And some didn't go also because their commanders disarmed them. And some didn't also go because they were also wounded, from what Johnson said, they were wounded. Some went out of the country and things like that. And then another key issue has to do with ESCOM, but who did register? They went through the process here and there. But the fact of the matter, after the training, they lack these employment opportunities, which they see to be more frustrating. And sometimes they regret why they even have to disarm. Sometimes they think that was a kind of strategy that the international community has established to take the guns from them. So it's also frustrating for them. And another group has to do with those. Another group has to do with those who are far away in terms of their area where the vehicles don't go, like the Vahon area. You can't easily go there with vehicle. And during the DD, you had to walk several hours to come to Vonjama. You got to have like few cantonment size in Vonjama. You have to walk there several hours. So some of them sat by, but this whole thing is like, it's like nonsense. Let me just do away with it. What are the things that guns over or what we don't really know. But they decided to forget about the process. And then lastly, what was also lacking has to do with the re-entry strategies. The entire DDRR program lacks psychosocial activities. You can do a check on that. You'll find out that there is nothing like psychosocial activities. They provide skill training here and they give you guys their packet in it. But there's nothing like some, you know, psychosocial activities. You also find out that during the activities, some ex-combatants came out with the desire to do computer, when in fact they have never been to school. And then those registered, recorded their names and information, but after they left the cantonment, they never had the opportunity because if you went to the computer school, the first requirement will tell you have to be a high school graduate because you must be able to read and write. So that was how they left the process. So it means that they were not given the kind of right option or a kind of career counseling to decide what they need to do. And some also decided to do agriculture. And in Monrovia, you can't easily do agriculture because you don't have the land space. And you see, so they never also took that into consideration because you have a vast land in the rural area where you can, you know, plant your crops and things like that. So you can't live in the city and then have a kind of land space to do agriculture. So that was also lacking. Then the issue about cooperators. There are a lot of ex-combatants that have been trained. At the end of the training, they gave them 2 kids. And they went and at a certain point in time, they had to settle 2 kids. Because they were not formed into a kind of group where they can begin to apply their skills or involve into some large skills production so that you can have buyers coming to buy whatsoever stuff and things like that. And then lastly, we also think and believe that there is no unique system for monitoring and evaluating the entire process. Yeah, right now to get a kind of unique figure to say, oh, how many ex-combatants really have been reintegrated. And we could give you some, you know, give you some percentage here and there, but a kind of monitoring and evaluation system to know precisely how many ex-combatants right now are gainfully employed, that are finding means of survival, that are taking care of their families, that have homes to live in, and that have some comfort in life, really, it's somehow difficult. So I want to thank you very much for listening. And once again, I want to say thanks to USRP for the invitation, CHF as well, and all other institutions. It is a nice and a great time being with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much to all of you. What we'd like to do now is take questions. I'll take maybe 3 at a time. And turn it over to them. So, yes. If you could also just identify yourself before.
I'm Harriet Nettles. I'm with Mediators Beyond Borders. And I'm curious to know on the last line there that you teach skills to deal with problems peacefully without resorting to violence. there a certain model that you use? And I would also be curious about the model that you see as being most successful in terms of trauma healing, or I believe you use the term spiritual cleansing.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Do you want to take one at a time? Yeah, I'm going to take maybe three at a time, and then
okay.
You can answer all of them. There are a couple other questions I can take now. Yes.
My name is Judy Livingstone, former Peace Corps volunteer in Liberia back in the 60s. I'm interested in a comparison of the difficulties of ex-combatants reintegrating and refugees who spend as many as 10 or 12 years away from Liberia trying to reintegrate, and whether programs are equally addressing the needs of both groups.
Yes.
I'm Daniel Weckland. I was in charge of the Landmine Action Field Research Project in Guthrie this year, April. So I was just curious, it seems that there was a large number of registered ex-combatants, I believe around 100,000, and only around 20,000 actual weapons collected. And I was just curious, do you think that impacts the how likely the international community is going to sustain the RRR side of it if they spend so much money on this? Because I know the groups that we were working with, especially the ex-coms in Guthrie, were quite unhappy at not having been registered in D1 and D2. They felt a lot of resentment towards those who they considered had not fought yet to see benefits. I was wondering if you see that reflected also on the international community side to sustain it.
Okay.
Yeah, we can start with the first one.
Okay, the first question from our mother actually has to do with the kind of tool that we use, right? And during the aspect of reducing conflict within communities and our own approach in the trauma healing. Our success in terms of the trauma healing approach actually has to do with the storytelling. Because trauma, the most difficult aspect in trauma healing has to do with the psychological trauma, because for that you don't really see it, except the person comes out to tell you what they went through, what they experienced, and how they felt about the situation. So upon those stories, you can be able to give them some coping mechanism, encourage them that life is still hopeful, you can still make it. There are even other people who went through worse situations. For you, you said that you lost your husband. But just imagine a kind of person who lost their entire family, their homes, and everything. So you still have a hope. And for the issue of the community, what we actually use has to do with the dialogue approach. We have a common saying, let's talk about it and not fight about it. Even though it is painful, but the more we talk about our differences, what are cultural, social, or ethnicity, but we believe that we can have a common ground. So these are some strategies and tools you use in terms of dealing with those kind of issues. And then the last aspect has to do with the number of ex-combatants left out of the process. What can the international community do to sustain the RRR for the fact that there have been a lot of investment in the process? To be frank, there is a need to stay, show some concern and support for ex-combatants left out of the process. The fact of the matter is that they are not happy why they left out of the process. And some have said boldly that if I don't receive my benefits, and I will stay, there are possibilities that I could still go back to war. And for our own experience, you know, as former combatants, a handful of former combatants given the opportunity where they are given arms and ammunition, and giving some petty cash, they can destabilize any society. Because the strategy is that the more you go about with your warfare, you can also be able to recruit. And during that, because the recruitment is such that they either force you to fight or you willingly decide to fight. And in considering the option, whether you should be killed or go to war, you'll find that most people decide to go to war. That was how, like, for me, I went to the battlefront. You know what I'm saying? Because they told me, if you keep talking too much, we'll get rid of you. So why you decided to? You have to go, whether you like it or not. So there is a need. Like why he said, the Guthrie issue is actually a kind of critical issue. And Landmine Action decided to approach it in a way that 400 of those guys from Guthrie Plantation, because they were there during the DDR era. They saw those robots as a means of opportunity for financial gain and livelihood. So they said that to hell with this whole DDR era, we remain right here and benefit from these robots. But at the end of the DDR era, they begin to find some difficulties wherein the fund belongs to the government and there is a need for the government to revitalize the place and be able to take full control. But at the end of the day, Lenma Action step in to see how better they can provide some psychosocial counseling and skills training in agriculture and what have you for them.
Just out of the loop. Okay, even in terms of the strategy that you just asked for, there's another unique kind that was also used in those communities that has to do with the formation of community peace council in those various towns. And that was a strategy that was introduced by CHF that is actually working. And in the formation of the Community Peace Council, we went about doing selection in the towns that all representatives of the town form part of that council. So if you are from the youth, the women group, the elder, the zoos, and all levels are part of the council of 12 members. And we have been giving them skills ranging from conflict management, mediation, trauma healing activities over the years. And then they have gone above now with those kind of techniques and strategy giving them to also handle their own community conflict, because there are some issues of land dispute, tribal differences and what have you. And you as an organization will not always be in a community, or sometimes you might not always have the funding to continue with that kind of work. So in your absence, it gives a kind of a spirit of ownership, where in your absence they can carry on their own mediation strategy. So there have been a lot of different styles being used in our community. We went with the community empowerment programs, and our last CHF was also able to come up with another kind of program that actually gives some mediation skill from the ABA, you know, mediation strategy that was widely used again. So we went training all of those community peace council to have those skills so that even in our absence they can be able to carry on their own community mediation. So that is also working, and it was a kind of a new technique on our side. Yeah, because most peace building institutions found themselves conducting training randomly just in the community giving skill with the belief that people could use their voluntary service to calm down violence in their own community. But if you do not solidify those kind of a strategy with a team, formation of team, someone will feel that they're not responsible to do anything. But if you are formed into a kind of a team, even if you're getting weaker, a member of the team will be able to serve as a kind of driving force to keep you focused. So that is actually working. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Godfrey plantation, we ourselves visited Godfrey, because when our situation erupted, CHR have us informed. Lensman Action also wanted people to have gone along with them that had a strategy. And it comes to the psychology of the ESCOM. And we actually helped, took them in few of the communities. And their strategy is such that those that that were spotted through their research will be taken to Tumutu, and they want to try the first 400 as a kind of pilot project, because it's a kind of new idea that was brought out from a different standpoint. We projected that it was very much necessary, since this guy have now gone through the DD and RR, and having this kind of an opportunity, there should be a kind of a life skill for social reintegration that has a very good component of
Lenma action plan,
and that will be actually looking at the psychosocial component. So if they will be dealing with the guys in the camp for a period of 6 months, and at the same time the exit strategy, as we were talking about, will lead us into the community, wherein before they can graduate, 2 months before they can graduate, NEPA can have a team in the field preparing the community along with Lenma Action team. A member of NEPA team along with Lenma Action team can be in the field preparing the community so that these guys can be reinsected. And it will be such that when the training is over, they can group them into a cooperative so that there can be more monitoring strategy as well. And that, we believe, could also work.
Do you want to add anything?
No.
No? Okay.
I think they could do a much better job addressing those issues than I ever could hope to.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Doshika. I'm John Hong with Women's Campaign International. My question is, you're doing work with women or women's groups, so in particular
what I asked is whether they do any work with women affected by the conflict.
We actually have, I should have pointed this out earlier, we actually have mics on either side, so we can also.
I'll project.
Okay.
I'm going to piggyback off of that question. My name is Jennifer Goldbrinson, and I'm a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University. And I am wondering if women ex-combatants are part of the team, as you call them, or if you incorporate them in separately into reintegration programs. And also, if some of the challenges that have been faced in the past in reintegrating women socially, economically, have been overcome, or if there are still hurdles there. And then the second part of that is, you talk about in your presentation, Gwen, reducing the tendencies to fight in a community sense, but I'm wondering about in a private sense, domestic aggression, for example, if that's also being addressed as a part of the reintegration process.
Okay. Well, we can take these two questions.
Yeah. The first issue is about NEPA's own activities with WAF. We call that WAF. That is women affected with the fighting forces. Women associated with fighting forces. Yeah, our program also have a focus. In our organization, we also have women, former ESCOM women, we call them WISE. They're also part of NEPA. And apart from that, even in the communities where we are working, we are also working along with them. Because one critical thing is that there are some of these ex-combatant, former combatant women who husbands and boyfriends died during the process. So what become of them? Another critical thing has to do with the children that they have. It's just that there is no kind of unique program for children of former combatants. That's another critical issue we have not addressed, and we don't also know whether other institutions are addressing it, except for UNICEF. Because for UNICEF, they are actually being focusing on this child soldier issue. So when it comes to the WAF approach, yeah, we also have that as part of our program. And I've just addressed your question about women becoming part of our organization that has to do with our membership. And one thing, our institution is open, not just to former combatant, but as well to non-combatants. If you see FA, and you think that you can contribute to the aspect of peace, because peace is beyond boundary, beyond the issue of gender, ethnicity, and what have you. So if you think and believe that you want to be part of the process, we can also incorporate you. And we also have with us, as an institution, members that have not gone to war, have not been to battle, but we are seeing a fate for the fact that since we are working with both the ex-combatants and the community, we believe that it is relevant. Because sometimes the community also come out with the issue wherein they see the ex-combatants are as being paid by the international community for the level of destruction, whether lives or properties. So we, in most of our training and discussion, that will make them to understand the reason why these things happen, and the essence for reconciliation, because if we don't reconcile, there are possibilities that we will go back to war. So do you love war? Do you want to see us fighting or running here and there? And they will say no. So there's a need for us to reconcile. But in this process of reconciliation, they also want some transformation from the ex-combatant end. And that also has to do with the community, because there should be transformation from all end in terms of acceptance, discussion, and recovery in the process and in our nation building.
Okay, just to add up to, you know, even in the process of rape cases, like in the case of the IRC program, women will not feel too pleased to talk to men about the kind of way they went through those kind of situations. They will feel more confident talking to women. So you definitely know that those that are on board, the NEPA team can be used for those kind of activity, because they're doing training. Some will be brave in their storytelling. They will even mention how they got raped. They might not go into detail because of shame and what have you. And people will be there taking notes to be able to make follow-ups on these kind of stories and
link them with the relevant institution that will also be able to give some support in that aspect. So we actually use women in those areas. So you see, the team has women who both fought the war and who are also community members, as he's saying, from those aspects. Yeah.
Even during the survey, UCFCHF and the NEPA survey, our team was such that we had people, you know, we have gender involvement, tribal involvement, so that as you go out there to talk to the ex-combatants, so that, you know, they will be willing to express to you. Where we ensure that a female talk to a female ex-com, because like that, she will be much open to give you information, you know, regarding the survey, since you want to have a good result.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are issues that we have been dealing with. Like what John said, the LGBT issue. If a woman is raped, she can freely talk to another woman, and you know, practically about what she went through. But for the men, she might not be too
free,
open, because she sees that as a means of disgrace and stigmatization. You see?
Yeah,
on that topic too, the NEPA served as our enumerators for the survey. That was one of the key roles that they played. Our enumeration team came exclusively from NEPA's forces. And one reason why NEPA was so valuable that way, and one of the real benefits that we got from that organization, is that it is so inclusive. And so we were able to get people from representing most of the major tribes in Lofan. We also were able to get both female and male enumerators. And I think there was a lot of value even in simply having women arrive in the community as part of the team. Even if a woman respondent weren't being interviewed by another woman, I think that there is also value for the women in the community who are going to be interviewed to see the team coming in and see that it is composed of both women and men, see the tribal variation in the enumerators. Even if they don't end up talking to a woman, you know, it sets a stage, it sends a signal about involvement, about who is being taken seriously, about the fact that gender issues are not going to be ignored because of the fact that someone like them is being represented in this team. And NEPA was very conscious of that, and I really think it brought a lot of value to the survey that way.
Thanks. You and then there's a...
Yes, I think Johnson said that if we don't reconcile, we go back to war. And you all are involved in trying to break the cycle of violence so that you don't go back to war. What are some other key factors that are very important in keeping you from returning to war?
Okay, another question.
My name is Michelle Cohen. I'm a grad student over at Georgetown University.
Well, I'm giving that people.
And I want to first thank you both for coming so far to share your personal experience with us, as well as your work. I appreciate the effort. My question is, you've talked a lot about micro-level or community-level initiatives, the reintegration work that you've done. I'm wondering if you could comment a bit about macro-level initiatives. Are there any specifically interested in private companies, private business? Have you been seeing any, either on the domestic level or international, companies coming over, investing in Liberia, and therefore adding to the employment opportunities that are available for ex-combatants trying to reintegrate? Thank you.
And
okay.
Do you have another question?
Hi, I'm Jessica Gayer. So I also had the opportunity to work with Landmine Action this summer, working with their tracking and researching on their ex-combatants.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is from your research, which was with general ex-combatants throughout different counties, is this who owns this data now? And did you keep the list of names of these ex-combatants who did not complete either DD or RR? And are there any plans to use those lists to maybe incorporate them in other DDRR programs? And also, as you came out with this research that was very critical of the way that DDRR was done, the lack of monitoring evaluation, the lack of follow-through with the RR component, did you find friction from the parties who were responsible for the national DDR programs? Like, did you find friction from people who were with UNDP, or the member states who donate to the National Trust? That's my question.
Okay. You don't know the last question?
Well, I can take the last question since it's not related to the survey.
You can take the last question, huh?
Let me just address some of the points in the last question, since that's directly related to the survey. Because of human subjects requirements, of course, and also because of the ethics involved in doing surveys, at no point do we ever take the names of the people who are responding to the survey. In fact, you might have noticed that there was a photo in the beginning of the presentation of somebody administering a survey to someone else, and it was their faces were blanked out. Because one thing that we take incredibly seriously is protecting these people's privacy and confidentiality. And, you know, we assure them that we take their confidentiality seriously and they can speak to us freely. And because of that, I mean, we don't keep any records of names at all. Each survey is given a number, and that's the only thing that's ever attached to it. And then in terms of what will happen to the data, I mean, the data is currently, you know, still under embargo in the property of USIP and CHF. But as with all data, I mean, the ultimate point is to let as many people as possible have access to it and learn from it. And eventually the data will be released and people will be able to bring their own ideas to bear on the data. And, you know, what came out of this, I mean, the survey did expose some flaws in terms of how DDRR was conducted in Liberia, and many of these were already flaws that people knew existed and simply quantified some aspects of these flaws. Our goal was not to do an evaluation of the DDRR program. I mean, it was certainly not the objective, nor was it the outcome. I think, you know, some of the people that I spoke to from UNMIL, and I did actually get a lot of support in Nvojima from the UNMIL forces there. I didn't feel any friction at all. I mean, I think if you ask the folks that are implementing DDRR, they will tell you that yes, there are some things that went right and some things that went wrong, and all of us are interested in improving the way DDRR is conducted. There will always be problems in it. I mean, you know, an incredibly sensitive situation, and a lot of last minute decisions being made. The nature of the process, but no, I mean, maybe when we start to publish things, I don't know what kind of reactions there will be. The data is very new. I mean, this project was just done this past spring, so it hasn't been very long. But as of now, we've received widespread support, and I think it's a great opportunity for dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to take some of the
the question. The mother asked back there in terms of possibility of not going back to war. What are things, right? That things that need to be done in order to sustain reconciliation and maintain the process and level of peace. One could actually be a kind of program that will enhance community cohesion in the programs towards peace, unity, and development. And a program too that will also address community reprisal against ex-combatants, because there are still some problems in between some communities and ex-combatants. The issue of forgiveness, and, you know, looking at the level of destruction, which is very much complicated, but there is a need that there could be programs to address those kind of issues. And then the issue about security is also very much important. There's a need to address the issue of security so that people will feel safe to move about, talk freely, and what have you. There should also be a need for good governance and the rule of law, because people sense that the government is not doing the appropriate thing, and that could still give them another opportunity of going back to war. Because for most ex-combatants, and they will always come up with problems of past government and the reason why they have to fight. So the government has to the government has to exhibit a kind of good governance and the rule of law, where everybody will feel free, where everybody would think that they are dealt with on the issue of justice and peace, so that there will be no partiality or favoritism and things like that. And then the issue that has to do with, because ethnicity has already been a kind of problem. Because sometimes when somebody goes to power, become a president, everybody want to know your background. Mm-hmm. As you know, even in the past, the issue about the American Liberian and the indigenous people. So these are things that we have to do away with. And, you know, tribal issues, and the issue of employment to also have to be looked at critically, because right now even there are a lot of people who don't have job, and there are even people from the UP party, United People's Party, and who are also redundant or downsized. They also have a problem. So people, there are too many problems. But if these problems can be dealt with, we know that it is not an overnight thing. But there should be a kind of holistic program, somewhere, somewhere that will engulf majority of the people, so that you won't just be languishing out there or sitting and doing nothing to make you think negatively. And this kind of program will actually help. But considering the issue of microloan, Johnson will say something about that.
Okay. Even on the line of program, as he just said, one effective program too that we are also being critically looking at has to do with this formation of cooperatives. Because actually when you talk about the return to war, people actually focus on the ESCOM. And if these guys, if the number that have gone through skill training and have a skill, if programs can be set up where in C funding can be given and putting those guys into cooperative like 6 or 12 pressing in the particular kind of course that they have done, that is also the form of employment. And then you can give them some financial management skill as to how that funding can be managed. And maybe you're taking per capita $100 or $200 per person. So if you are putting 6 persons in a group, you expect $1,200 that will be able to buy them materials and what have you that will put that group together. And then you can set your own community mobilizer who will be able to mobilize this group and be able to make follow-up on them as to how products can also be linked to buyers and how the proceeds can be divided in terms of percentage, wherein you can tell them 40% go back to the cooperative as pay or salary for them, and 60% can be saved into a kind of a banking or local bank institution. Because if you took into consideration the first 500 person over the period of 6 months, you definitely know that that C fund can also be transferred to another 500 in another 6 months. So gradually you will find out that such an organization or such a program will definitely cover a lot of people in terms of employment. And that strategy can actually work. Yeah. That's one aspect. And then on the issue of the issue of the government is actually trying its best, because for the past 14 years, there have been a lot of things. There have been huge deaths all around. You hear Liberia's name in that. The government is coming with a kind of a policy, because as everybody knows, you have to set a standard so that you can pass through the wall of pre-assessment up to the point of auditing, wherein any organization will want to see you being transparent to be able to work with you. So the government is actually working on that to set up a kind of policy, a financial policy that will actually put Liberia on top. And you can see that Liberia is gradually evolving to that level where people have started trusting the government, and NGOs have started going in, or companies have started going in, carrying on some assessment as to where they can get themselves, you know, connected. People in the logging area, people in the mining area, in terms of gold and diamond and that of iron ore, people are going. But except they can complete their own assessment and set up their own structure before thorough employment, you know, can start going on. And we also have to look at the level of employment, because people who have also gone through the wall of the universities are languishing around. So there are stages. It's not only the ex-combatant. So you could even employ the ex-combatant and leave those that have gone through their rough studies and what have you and have skill to wear and don't have employment. They can also be so vocal. So people have to look at it from different levels. So, and we believe that most ex-combatants will work, because some of the institutions will have place for security. They will have some labor job that has to do with changing train tracks and all sort of things, carrying on some construction, laying on new camps and what have you. So there will be a lot of opportunity when these standards have been met, and the government is actually working in that direction, where you see more people coming all of the time expressing interest in those areas. So we feel that some of those areas will be addressed in terms of employment. Thank you.
You and the person behind you, and there's a hand in the back.
I first want to say how impressed I am by your work, and congratulations on
really
being a service to your country. And my question is, what needs you have as an organization now? appreciated being a little more specific than just money. I know we all need more money, but if there are certain needs that you have as an organization, or if you want to make that broader and just as a country.
Yeah, there are a few areas as an organization that one will actually focus. One has to do with human development, because the kind of work we do requires a lot of practitioners. And you don't have to depend on local strategies as well. But there can be means where training opportunity can be given to people who are already involved so that new strategy can be developed as to how the community can be engaged. That can be fine. And given the kind of locality we work, some logistical support could also be very necessary in that direction to build up your own capacity. Because there are times, if you are depending on one vehicle and you get into the field to do your work and the vehicle had a breakdown, it definitely means that you will have a delay in getting the kind of deliverables that you need to get. So these are areas people need to look at. And there are a few programs that will actually operate in our own localities. So it's like, if you can deal with the human resource area or deal with logistic area or come to maybe the program area, we also do peace and reconciliation. We are in that area at levels. And we are involved with SGBV, activity and protection. We are also involved in youth initiatives. You see, as well as another new one that we just added has to do with the HIV awareness, because we found out that the population that we are dealing with is very huge. And most workshops that are being carried out in terms of HIV awareness, people are now actually looking at this other group. So we feel that it is necessary that to handle the situation holistically, you have to actually carry on these programs to be able to effectively implement your work.
And then to also be aware of the kind of programs we implement and activities, you can look at our website. We have a newly established website. We actually want to be grateful for the establishment of the website and, you know, by Gwen and our good friend. So we have this website, www.nepr, that is NEPA, N-E-P-R, and then Liberia, L-I-B-R-I-A, .org. That is our newly established website, but there are other information that we hope to put into it. But as you go through it, you'll get to know the kind of programs that we implement and what we have achieved, you know, so far, and what we still hope to do. Because peace is a process, one, and it requires a kind of partnership and collaboration.
Yeah,
yeah, from a universal standpoint. Because if one country is affected by war, there are possibilities that war could escalate and engulf the entire globe. So we need a level of partnership, collaboration, and support.
Can I actually comment on that, too? I think one of the best things that can be done for development in post-conflict countries is to have international NGOs and researchers partnering with local NGOs. And I think it works two ways. I think the opportunities for capacity building in organizations that are already formed but yet struggling, the opportunities are immense. I think, you know, when CHF started working with NEPA, I can't even imagine how beneficial it must have been to NEPA just to have the exposure to an international organization, to see how it functions. I know that when I was working with NEPA, we had a couple computer workshops that we did where some of the folks at NEPA got email for the first time. That's had some interesting results for my email box. But also, from my standpoint as someone who implements projects in developing countries, I can't imagine doing it without local NGOs. We both benefit so much from it in terms of, you know, there are communities I never could have gone in without NEPA support. There are connections I never could have made. And so part of what I'm always encouraging other researchers to do is find a local NGO, contact them, and see what kind of mutually beneficial partnerships you can establish there. I really think it's one of the most productive things that can be done on both ends.
Thanks. The gentleman.
Yeah. Hi, Colby Goodman from Amnesty International. and I actually had an opportunity to go to Liberia in September and to meet with NEPA in Bwenjima and Monrovia. And we were focused on, some of your questions, we were focused on women and girls, both sort of as affected by the conflict and that were formally associated with the fighting forces. So my question and sort of the concern sort of following up on what you guys were talking about is we talked with the major donors, being the US and the UK, and then some of the other international humanitarian organizations. And it seemed from our discussions that there was a real lack of interest and continuing to fund RR programs. They sort of wanted to, you know, stop that type of funding and sort of focus on the national poverty reduction strategy and doing some other things. So that sort of raised some alarms for us and concerns. So I wonder if you have, if you feel like you're able, you know, if you have any suggestions or if you feel like you're able to still get some funds, and you've talked a little bit about the types of programs that you think are important, but
yeah.
I think that there's a question in the back. Yes, and then.
Yes, hello. I'm Lauren Gillius. I recently served as the Republic International Law and Policy Group, and my question has to do with the survey. How do you use the information that you gather from the voluntary information given from people who are not selected to be part of the random sample? Just how did you use it, and how did you find it to be valuable?
I have a question about private corporations, both national and international. I'm Donna Reed from ARD. And a lot of the work that we do lately has been involving international corporations in development work, so bringing companies like Exxon or Coke or whoever into countries and developing the industry there, which in turn is creating jobs. And I'm wondering if any of that is happening in Liberia at the moment?
Let me address that. Few people have expressed interest, as I earlier said. A lot of people are going back. Some want to get themselves involved in building children's village. Some want to come back in the form of building supermarkets and what have you. Some want to get involved into diamond-related work. Mm-hmm. Some want to get into the mining sectors and a lot. But it's like that also has to go through its own process, because that's the office of the president. Yeah, you got to go through those areas and what ministry you need to sign document with and all of these things, mm-hmm. and what assessment you need to go on before you can start your kind of work. If it is something that has to do with construction, you also have to look at the kind of community you want to work in, or you want such an establishment to be in. So that also lies with the individual who has interest in carrying such a program. Some people will say Morovia is crowded up and there is no space for building, so I want to do something on the EWA highway leading towards the airport. Some people will say I want to be in Bong County. So all of those things are like process that you have to pass through. But interests are also there. And that when those things are carried, it will actually help the recovery process. It will help a lot. There will be a lot of employment opportunity given to Liberians. You see?
Can I follow up on that for just a second? Has there been any contact, I'm sure there has been, between Liberia and the Millennium Challenge Corporation, looking at developing it, bringing Liberia up to what they call compact, where they're actually, you know, developing different industries and different ways of creating jobs and improving the economy and bringing up the standard of living?
Yeah, there have been a lot of policies and discussion regarding the issue. In fact, one key concern has to do with GMAP. I'm sure everybody is somehow familiar with the GMAP, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But these policies and discussion has to come down to the grassroots level. Mm-hmm. Because in Liberia is such that there is a high percentage of illiteracy rate, about 80%. So to get information to the people, it takes time. Mm-hmm. And people need to understand as a government what you are involved with, what level of discussion you are going through. Mm-hmm. And not just coming up with the policies, but let people understand the policies. And after the policies understood, let the policies also be implemented. Because most of the time people come up with policies, they don't implement it. And in most of these discussions, sometimes people have their own interest. And you know, what a personal interest, governmental interest, or the investor interest, because the investor too also has an interest. So from these various levels, these are critical things that that need to be worked on. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, but there are a lot of prospects in terms of the recovery process. We want to say to you that Liberia is free. So if you have been thinking that Liberia is dangerous, it's not a place to go, it's not a place to live, we will still go back to war. We want to assure you that there are high level of possibility and certainty that Liberia won't go back to war. But the issue also has to do with the full implementation of the RR. To just address your question, the issue about donor fatigue is a practical thing. Anybody can suffer from fatigue.
Yeah.
So by donor experiencing fatigue, it's practical. They must experience it. They must understand it. But they also need to beef up their effort. Because it's better to see the process being fully completed, looking at the level of investment and the number of years that we have come, than to just reach at the verge of success and then you say, no, let me just relax and go back. Then there will be no reason
why you started.
So the race is not to the swift, either and due to the end.
And then let me just add up a little bit of just what he said. That controversial actually came up from a portion of some guys that went through the RRR outside the standard of the NCDD RRR and UNDP standard. Because they were saying that you have to go through the walls of training, you get certificates for whatsoever training that you have gone through, or go through the walls of training and get skills so that you can be able to have yourself, you know, reintegrated into the community smoothly. But they found out that there was some community-based program that were being carried out. Like LCRP were doing side brushing of roads, and they were paying ex-combatants to do the work. So a lot of ex-combatants move in that direction. And whenever you go, before you can be accepted to work on that role, they will have to see a demobilization ID card. So there were also track record kept on the number of people that participated in the side brushing of roads. But side brushing of roads was not a skill. So over 9,000 people benefited from that. And then the donors were saying that those that had the opportunity to have worked for local, through the community-based activity, don't need to go through another form of RR. So there where the situation was. If people work in the community and they were paid for their service, does that stop them from going through RR? That was not just an RR in its totality when it comes to their standard. So there were situations where actually, and they were discussing it. And at last, I think the UNDP have to decide that NCDDR take over the program as a form of ownership. So now NCDDR is also in the process of seeing what they can do to make sure that the rest of the guys can be reached. But it's a difficult stuff that we're talking about. As he said, in the case of donor fatigue, because a lot of institutions pump money into that trust fund. So if they have also decided that the amount of money that was raised to carry on the training or to carry on the process was sufficient to have ended the process, and you're coming back down to have them inform that the process is not completed and we need this amount of funding to do so, they might decide to tell you no, because they have spent a lot into the trust fund. But practically, people have been in Liberia, they have carried on research, they also know what we're talking about. When you look at the Guthrie scenario, it is not only Guthrie alone. You go in Lofa, you will see people who have not been who did not go through disarmament. You go in Nimba, you will find people who did not go through disarmament. Grand Jida, the Romans were all over the country. Liberia is a very small country. So people left out. And those are not even people that they are talking about in the DDRR program. Because they don't even have record on them. They don't even have ID card. So if NCDDR got money to support DDR program, before you benefit from it, you must have a DDRR card. So just think about that. Those that did not disarm are not even part of that. They're not even talking about them. So it's a critical situation.
So we want to encourage a donor. If you are here, really not to give up. You have really come too far with your support and contribution towards the peace process than to reach at the verge of seeing Liberia now experiencing peace, stability, and development. And then you drop back. That will actually be terrible for us as a nation. So I want to encourage you not to give up.
You want to address the survey?
I will. So I talked to many, many people one-on-one while I was in Liberia doing the survey here, and there's a couple of reasons to do that. I think in terms of researchers that are working quantitatively now, doing doing survey work and doing data analysis, there's an excessive backlash towards what they call anecdote. And I really cannot imagine running a survey without simultaneously speaking to people in an interview setting, in casual conversations, in their communities, to get some kind of context for what you're talking about. I mean, I can't envision what it would be like to do interpretation of survey results without some kind of practical hands-on understanding from conversations, unstructured conversations with people, to give you some kind of idea of what makes sense. And you know, and the second objective to is also, of course, when you're doing these kind of surveys in communities and you know that you can't speak to everyone, you want everyone in the community to feel like their opinions are important, and their opinions are important, and you want them to know that if they have something that's on their mind, their voice can be heard too. And as a researcher, that's something that's really important to me. And we're actually doing something. The next phase of this project is a somewhat unique phase for projects like this, and that is I'm actually heading back to Liberia in the spring. I'm going to work with these guys and actually disseminate some of these results in the communities where we worked. And so we're going to head back with some of the survey data. I'm going to have my computer in hand with the data right on it, head back to these communities and say, in layperson's terms, this is the result of what you told us. This is what we've learned. What do you think? How would you interpret these results? What's surprising, what isn't? Because, I mean, the more information you can get from these communities, the better. I mean, if you have people at your disposal who've lived through the war, who've gone through all of these experiences and are willing to talk to you, my goodness, the idea of neglecting to do so seems ridiculous. And they deserve to have this information disseminated to them as much as anyone else. I mean, without their participation, we'd be nowhere. So maybe I've gotten a little much too much into my philosophy of survey doing, so I'll cut it off there.
Are there other questions? No? Yes?
James Kugel with the PRIO Peace Research Institute of Oslo. My research was with UNMIL, UNDP in Liberia in 2006 with the ExComs doing evaluations. One of the questions, research questions, of course, is where are the guns? Less than 30,000 weapons collected since disarmament, maybe 500 more have been picked up. So the question is, well, there's two sides. People will say, well, we didn't get all the guns, okay? But I would say, did we get the guns? I think we might have got the guns. Living through two phases of the war and seeing a pretty poor disarmament the first time in 96, and now going through a second disarmament where there's a lot of visibility on the weapons. And all of the, you guys know in the villages where they go, people buried them, they pull them out, they disarm the second time. Mm-hmm. There are stories of keeping them for protection. What I'd like to know is if what are your feelings on how well we actually disarmed them and got the guns out of the country? And should we be focusing on programs to find the guns in the country or focusing on programs to keep the guns out of the country?
Okay. I think there was somebody behind. Yes.
Justin Goldman, Defense Department. Has your organization been contacted by some of the government levels in terms of vetting the people that apply within the security sector reform in the new armed forces of Liberia?
Okay.
I never got the second question too well.
Could you repeat the second question?
In the SSR process, has your organization been contacted in terms of vetting the applicants to the new armed forces of Liberia?
Okay.
You got it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Whether we'll contact the organization. Okay, is that all right?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay. I will begin with the second question. You come for me. The first question, I didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. You got it right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I will address the second question, the issue about the reformation of the National Army. is more or less a governmental issues. Yeah, and a kind of international partnership. Yeah, I don't even want to think and believe that local international organizations, you know, are deeply involved into it, because that has to do with a kind of reformation of the security sector. Okay, NEPA is not close to that. Yeah, there is nowhere where we have recommended anybody to go and join the new army or so.
I'm sorry, with me, I'm with y'all's experience in the vast range of who you're involved with. You know, there's been a real increased effort in terms of vetting, new people being, brought into forces, and an organization like yourselves, it would seem like would be an entity that could be able to say, no, these people have not been involved in any human rights violations, things of that nature.
Yeah.
Let me just give you, it could have been
a great opportunity if that was done, wherein people who have been fighting with other guys in the war knew each other and knew how terrible the war they were and the kind of violations they got themselves involved in. It could be of a good picture if we were contacted, or if our voice could also be heard to participate. It could have been fine. Even in the sensitization, because there are sensitizations going around. They have placards, and people go around and inform people, police people as well go around, and inform people, military observers go around, and inform people as to how the recruitment is. But it's also risky to see somebody in the face and tell somebody that this guy was a terrible warrior and he cannot be a kind of a soldier for the nation. You should know that your security also involved. Yeah. So we have to be looking at that too, because the country is very small. You can see somebody in Vonjaman today and he appear in Moravia after 3 days and you see the president. You see, because Moravia is almost like the center of everything. So when you go far, you got to come. You go far, you got to come, just like that. It could also be risky. Maybe that was some of the strategy why the people decided. But they came out with a standard that before you join the army, you should be a high school graduate. And after 3 months, they could not even get much. One stigma was, it's not necessary to be a soldier because you're not actually going to get anything from there. And now they started to add up to their own sensitization strategy, where even those that graduated, they started giving scholarship to some of them to further their education. So people saw that as a form of opportunity. Oh, but I can join the military, I can have an opportunity to go for study. So I'm going to join the military, I can be in the engineering department, whatever. Parents have even started talking to their children to join. So the strategy is also working, you see. And even when you go towards the police, that also went on, where at first they went to high school graduate. And when they went around, they could not find much. Just imagine a country that has just 20% literacy rate, and even at different level, people who have gone through college educations and what have you might not actually want to find interest in joining the military or the police. But since they saw that there was some form of opportunity, people have also started mounting all their own pressure to join. So the strategy is at different level. But we feel that maybe the government thought that it would have been risky if they had people involved in showing people that this man did this and this man did that. You could also be like digging up new wounds. You see? And then in the area of the gun, as you said, disarmament went on. And I believe in 2006, you were staying in Liberia, you saw the performance of UNDP small arm program, wherein disarmament was true and people still went in the community and they got armed. So that definitely proved that arm was still in the community. And as you likely said, there are fights in what you said wherein people, warlords, used to bury arms. You see, people used to put arms in plastic, grease it up with all kind of different kind of oil, tie it up and put it in a well, because they know that something will still happen. So if you came around and collected something, at the end of the day, you found out that this group still have arms. And that can also be proven by even the rate of armed robbery that is going on. Where can the guys get the arm? So it is likely that arms are still in the community. It could be at a low percentage. And people might have kept them because of some reasons. So there is still a need to mount on some kind of program that could be initiating the collecting of arms and what have you. And you also know the border systems in Liberia. We have a porous border. You can walk from any back road and just enter Liberia. You don't even have to go through the immigration and what have you. That is obvious. That it could be easy for arms to be brought into the country from outside, where even CHF office was robbed, and the armed robbers that robbed the office came from Guinea. You see, they walked through and they came in, and they were in the town for a few days, according to the information we gathered. And that night, the guys walked at the compound and put everybody on a gunpoint. And the surprising part of it was like, the financial officer had just come from Monrovia with salaries, program funding, and he entered like today. That night, the robbery occurred. So you see how terrible it was. People phone were taken from there, computers were carried away, project funding were taken. You know, it is risky. So due to the fact that we have porous border, it's also necessary where people can find interest in a kind of program that can stop arms from coming in the country. Because you are not going, the government will not actually set immigration to all of the towns that border in Guinea. There were even a situation where immigration officers went to Bakedu to take a assignment and the community refused. That was a tedious situation where you have to get involved and other stakeholders have to get involved to talk to the guys, because what they said was like, from the days of old, there had been no immigration office in Bakedu. Bakedu is the kind of big town in Lofa County, wherein a lot of roads are linking to Bakedu. You see? And the people felt like, if you left from the border line and passed through the Jamulo, or even Samodu or Womandu and got to Bakedu, you will still be able to encounter the immigration and other, you know, governmental people that are supposed to be working in that area. But when they went there, the Bakedu people said that office had never been here. So you take your office from here and carry it to the border line. Because they also knew how they used to come in and how they used to go out. And deeply when you look at that, it's also linked to this tribal situation. Maningo wanting more of the people from Guinea to come in so that the population can be more, because they are also fighting for status. So how can they bring the people in? They bring them in by means of subcontracting, the acting that they're using as contractor to come and cut palm or make farm and what have you. And when they come in after a few months, they become citizens. So they don't want the government to keep eye on that, because when people come strange from Guinea, you will know. We know each other. We will know. Because if you're from Guinea, even you want to speak the Loma, French will be on the Loma. You want to speak Pere, French will definitely be on the Pere. So we will know that you're not a Liberian. But pretty close, those are strategies too that people are also using for their own ethnic background, population to be more. So if you can have program in those directions, can also work. You can have program controlling the inner aspect with the few arms that are still there to be collected. And you can also have program that will stop arms from entering into the country. So that can also work.
Yeah, but there are, from what John said, there are still few guns around. It's just that you hardly see them. But we still believe that there are guns. But the fact that there are armed robbery and some criminal activities, there are guns. But there should also be a kind of program to address those kind of situations in order to have a kind of peaceful society. And you see. And there are guns in some other places where people could not even remember. There are other places where people could actually tell you that we have guns in certain areas that need to be upgraded. But it depends on the kind of program that will address these situations. And, you know, but right now, UNDP, as Johnson said, is involved into this small arm control program where we have like guns for development. So if the communities come out to identify where weapons are, to the influence of one or a group of people, then they will provide some level of development for that community. So they are working on that, and gradually they are discovering hidden weapons, you know, grenade ammunition, things like that. And, but it's a gradual process. And the process, because sometimes people are somewhat skeptical. If I be the one to identify where the weapon is, I might be implicated. They want to know how I got to know. And who carried a gun there, and blah, blah, blah. And you see? So sometimes, but it depends on the kind of program that will motivate community dwellers.
Thorough sensitizations and what have you. And even there are other things that people have not actually been touching. The issue of mass grave, one of the protection sessions and what have you. Some community you go in and conducting training, they will actually tell you. I was in a group where 15 person was killed and we buried them this place. I was in the group where 30 person was killed and they buried them this place. Those could also be a very good structural program where kind of a unique barrier could be given to local number of people. You know? And there are a lot. There are a lot. But you know, when you start taking visit to Liberia, you will vividly see what we are talking about. And I know other people have had the opportunity to have been there. They can definitely see what we are talking about. You see? And just what, there was a question she raised, and it's just a time I also have to be given to other people. When we started our training, first in those communities, we had a strategy where we could bring the community dwellers and that of the ex-combatant into training at once. But in one or two different kind of training, there was a kind of a huge eruption and what have you. Because using trauma healing as a form of tools for transformation, we actually usher these guys into the healing process wherein they feel willing to come from within and tell stories. And then you will find out that ex-combatant will be giving a specific story in a specific location that a participant in the workshop, family member were there, and they got killed. So you see the kind of a terrible situation. And you will see that the person will burst into tears, will rush on the person and catch that, you kill my this and you kill my that, and it becomes tense. So we went back into our own strategic planning and said that it's necessary to deal with these guys from two separate ends before even bringing them to a capacity building point. So that at least it would be more softening, even if somebody was given the kind of situation where your brother was found in the height, you might have had some level, you know, of tolerance to be able to tolerate the person so that they can be able to share their stories. You must be able to respect the person to give their own view from that standpoint. And it can also help the healing process. But it was difficult from the beginning. And at times when you try this strategy, you see that it doesn't work. You have to come back and re-strategize. We experienced all of those things. You see, Alfredo was in the group and was discussing how disabled ex-combat people who got wounded from the front line was being killed when Chatterer was about to leave the country. And he was giving the story that at that time he was an ATU personnel. And he was ordered to fire these guys when they brought them from the executive mansion in a truck and then dug a kind of big hole with the caterpillar, and then asked they gave order to the truck driver to dump these guys in the hole. And then most of them who were at least stronger, that were trying to make their way to run, there was order given for them to shoot at them. And this guy said he was standing and in the form of being numb, and then the gun was in his hand. His friend had to walk from behind him and came and pop him on his shoulder and said, "Fire!" Because the guy who people refer, they used to call 50, who was one of the ringleaders for Charles Taylor, Benjamin Yetem, he was the one who was ahead of that mission. You see, and that portion of that area is on the clay highway when you're going to bombing. When the guy started explaining that in the training session, there were other guys whose brothers were wounded and they were in the hospital behind the executive mansion because it was such that Charles Taylor never went there for lawyer to actually know that manpower were getting wounded from the front line. So his strategy was they were building in the executive mansion ground that they were keeping these guys, so that they will not spread all over the street for people to see how people are getting wounded and that the war was turning against the government. That was the strategy. So they were keeping them there, paying them regularly, giving them food and what have you. But when he was about to leave, the people have to leave the mansion ground. So some of his strategy was to kill, destroy evidence before leaving. And when that boy explained the story in the workshop, it was not an easy situation. You see, people jumped on him, people wanted to fight and what have you. We have to cool that tension. And those were lessons that we learned that make us to come up with another strategy, that you have to engage the combatant from one end, engage the community dweller from one end, preparing them more before you can bring them together at another level. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, people have different perceptions about each other. The community has different perceptions about people who fought war, and those that fought the war also have different perceptions about the community. So you have to give them the two sides of the coin. This is how the community look at you. But they will desist from looking at you if you behave this way, behave that way, and behave this way.
Yeah.
You see? And you have to tell the community that this is how the ex-combatant look at you.
So if you don't also address the situation in this manner and in this other manner, it means that you people will not coexist. That means that bridge will never be there. So there are different strategies that you can get yourself involved in.
Yeah. And there are conflicting situations from every end in every area. Even among the community dwellers, they have their own conflicting situation. Even within the ex-combatant and group, they have their own conflicting situation. Among the community and the ex-combatant also have. So there are a kind of proliferation of conflict all over. But as we keep talking and dealing with it, we believe that we'll find a way out.
For some common example, I don't know whether... Yeah, for some common example, when two community dwellers went in a particular area and hid their material, and then the war took them from there. And then they came back. One of them came back before the friend, and then decided to go to where they had a hidden material, took all and came with it. And the next person came and never found theirs. One of these days when they bought at the well or at the pump, you will find out that there's a kind of conflict. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. This has been a very rich discussion. I'm glad you could all stay till 5:30. I don't know if you want to if you have any closing remarks or...
Nope.
No?
Okay. Just a hearty thank you again to USIP and to CHF both, but mostly to NEPA for coming all this way and tolerating our weather and our strange food and all the other inconveniences of American life. So thank you so much, John.
Thank you.